Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in History. I'm Stephen Colebrook. Today I'll be speaking with Katie Batzer, author of Before AIDS, Gay Health Politics in the 1970s, published in 2018 by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Batzer uncovers the history of gay health politics in the 1970s, challenging the notion that the gay community was unprepared for the AIDS epidemic. Focusing on three health clinics in Boston, Chicago, and Los Angeles, Batzer examines how the nascent gay health movement interacted with doctors, social movements, and the state. Katie, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you on here. So I'd like to begin by asking you about your own intellectual background and what brought you to the topic of the gay health movement.
Sure. There's a short version and a long version. I came out when I was very, very young, and I went to the library, and there were no history books at all on LGBT history. And so I knew that that was something that I wanted to do because I was a big history fan from my first history course when I was like 12. Fast forward about 10 years, and I find myself getting ready to go to graduate school in Chicago. And I knew that I wanted to do something that looked at the intersection of health and politics and sexuality. And every day on my way to school, to class, I passed by this place called the Howard Brown Health Clinic. And it took me a couple months to realize that it was specifically for the LGBTQ community. And I just became fascinated by the potential history of this space. And eventually that became where my research, it kind of drew me to this topic.
Mm-hmm. So it's really been fermenting for a while. Mm-hmm. So your introduction charts some of the research challenges you faced examining these institutions, especially sort of incomplete archival records. I was wondering if you just describe for us how you overcame these challenges and what methodologies you used to do that.
Yeah, so it was extremely difficult, actually. The archival records for these clinics, in today's world, we wouldn't really think of them as clinics. We would think of them as like, oh my gosh, are you kidding me? This is where you want me to go get my medical care. But folks were really desperate to provide gay friendly and knowledgeable healthcare back then, and so it was often, you know, a very slapdash organization where medical records were kept on index cards, and the idea of having some sort of organizational record keeping was really an afterthought at best. And then marry that to the reality that AIDS came shortly after these clinics kind of finally became institutionalized and strong enough and had a clear sense of, oh, we should be billing people and we should keep records, these sorts of things. Then they met the AIDS crisis, where space constraints became real in terms of where were they going to keep all of the patient files and all of the information. And for a number of the sites that I looked at, the answer was they were just going to pitch the historic stuff. And so, you know, for Fenway here in Boston, for example, there really was just one or two small file folders with articles of incorporation and not much more beyond that. And it was a daunting task. And actually my dissertation advisor, he kind of made me prove that there was enough out there before he granted me permission to move forward with the project. And it took me 2 years to kind of scrounge up enough. So I did a lot of oral interviews. I started out by finding the archives that I could, and then reading tons of newspapers, gay newspapers, straight newspapers, medical journals, and really trying to piece together who the main characters were and who was talking to newspapers, who were publishing medical findings, and then kind of going from there and having a snowball effect of interviews and looking at people's personal papers and, you know, gaining access to people's closets and basements and attics. And it was a long haul. It was very humbling. And it was also incredibly rich and meaningful way to write my first meaningful historical research, because I really had to build relationships with these people in order to tell the history. And so it was very challenging. I tried the best that I could to use whatever available archives at universities and things like that. But really, it was very rare for me to have access to archives as most historians think of them, where they're cataloged and, you know, you can just look up the finding aid, things like that. That was not my reality. There were points where I was literally trying to follow people through, you know, different years worth of phone books to see if I could find their most up-to-date phone number.
Great. So I have two sort of completely unrelated follow-up questions to that, which is who was your dissertation supervisor and how did you go about securing oral interviews?
Yes. So my dissertation advisor was the amazing and wonderful John D'Amelio. I was very fortunate to be one of his graduate students. And he was very supportive, but also didn't want to give permission for something that ultimately just didn't have enough, you know, research or material there to actually support what I needed to do. And then in terms of how did I secure all the interviews, I begged. I really did. I there were a number of times where I would just cold call people. You know, a lot of this research kind of happened pre-Facebook and pre-smartphone. The internet obviously existed, but it was a little bit tricky to get those initial interviews. And then once I had the hook of one person and tried to tell them about the history that I was wanting to tell, people would pass along the names of their friends, or sometimes would even, you know, call them up while I was there and say, "Hey, so-and-so is here. You should just come over." And so all of a sudden, you know, this interview that I would prep for would turn into an interview with three other completely different people. And it was, a challenge, but sometimes that was the way that I just had to roll with it. And, it was interesting.
Yeah. Great. So, your introduction and chapter one sort of outlines some of the context for the rise of these gay health clinics. So I was wondering what historically the gay community's relationship was like with the medical profession.
Oh, yeah. I mean, fraught is putting it nicely. I think that there is a well-deserved skepticism and fear among today's LGBTQ community, but certainly the 1970s iteration of the gay community around interactions with medical professionals. Up until 1973 here in the US, homosexuality was still seen as a mental illness. And so generally, if you went to a doctor and said that you were gay, that would become the reason that you came to the doctor in the eyes of the medical professional that you were talking to, regardless of whether you were actually going because you were sick in some other way, you know. And the treatments that some doctors would prescribe were just horrendous across the 20th century. I mean, there's cases of castration or chemical castration and electroshock therapy and all of these sorts of things. And so people were very reluctant to actually go to the doctor and and doubly so to go to the doctor and come out, which had serious implications for their sexual health.
So how did the gay community respond to this stigmatization?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, there's been some interesting work around trying to get the history of trying to get the diagnostic statistical manual that doctors used to diagnose mental health disorders to try and get homosexuality removed from that. So that happens in 1973, and that's a big deal. But really what happens is, from what I notice in my book, there are two angles. One is that gay activists really try and kind of politicize the concept of health and make it part of gay liberation. Another way that folks go about kind of challenging mainstream medicine is by kind of infiltrating it from within. So people that are coming out as gay are also in medical school and wanting and seeing their friends in the gay community struggling with different things and wanting to know why they're not learning how to actually treat these real live illnesses and going about it that way. So they kind of take on medicine straight ahead by saying, we're this big activist group and we're going to challenge it in all these other ways. And then there are also those that are kind of working undercover and trying to make the mainstream medical organizations, professional organizations, more gay friendly and kind of queering it from the inside in a way.
So you mentioned gay liberation there, and your history takes place in the 1970s. So I was wondering, in this sort of post-Stonewall world, how the ideology of gay liberation interacted with the politics of health and the health clinics you describe.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. So I looked at kind of three major case studies for the book, and one, LA, really embraces the notion of gay liberation and really kind of puts their activism as a frame. And it also echoes the activism that's happening elsewhere in Los Angeles at the time. So they really borrow this notion of access to, like, they use this term oppression sickness that they actually borrow from Black Panthers and other kind of the Brown Berets, and even the Feminist Women's Health Movement are all kind of using different iterations of this notion of oppression as a form of sickness to equate the push for gay liberation as also a push for access to healthcare and access to just being able to live healthy lives without being pathologized or without being denied healthcare or access to quality, well-paying jobs that also allow for higher quality life. And so that's how LA kind of relates itself to gay liberation. It very much embraces it. Chicago, that's where most of the doctors are kind of secretly coming out in their night lives and then kind of working behind the scenes in medical schools. And gay liberation is kind of a secondary thought. It's more about medicine and being doctors. And then Boston is a totally different case study where gay liberation is happening, sure, but the people who start the Fenway Clinic here in Boston are actually doing so out of a push against gentrification of a neighborhood where gay people happen to live. It's a very racially and sexually diverse neighborhood in Boston, and it's set to be razed and replaced with higher income housing units. And so they create a whole bunch of different community organizations to kind of push back against that. And a clinic is one of them. And within that clinic, they decide to include some gay health services, but they never really embrace the notion of gay liberation. And they don't actually claim the identity as a gay clinic until into the 1980s, actually. And so it just is a community clinic in this funny way. Whereas now when we think of Fenway Clinic, nationally, they're one of the biggest LGBTQ health organizations in the country.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Fantastic. So the history you described parallels developments in the feminist and civil rights movements as they also begin to politicize health. So I was wondering how did these gay health clinics interact with other social movements of the 1960s and 1970s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, this is where the individual people really matter, right? We think about these big movements as kind of their own monolithic entities that make huge decisions and operate on their own. But really, what my research finds that there are individual people who are the kind of catalysts of ideas from one place to another place, from one group or movement to another movement. And so certainly in Los Angeles, in Boston, that's what I see happening, is that there are individual people who have been involved in the civil rights movement and have ties to kind of Black nationalism, or are well acquainted with the feminist women's health movements and their different iterations. And that translates to meetings that they have in their neighborhoods or around other health issues that eventually materialize as these gay health clinics.
Mm-hmm. Great. So your third chapter sort of intervenes into debates historians have about how sexual minorities interacted with the state, which has been a sort of flourishing area of scholarship in the last 10 years or so. So I was sort of wondering, first of all, how gay health clinics interacted with the state, and also how your book adds to and revises the concept of the straight state articulated by Margot Kanaday.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, and I'm a huge fan of Margot Kanaday's work, and it's a slight revision. It's not necessarily I'm not saying that she's wrong. I want to be very clear about that. I think that the state generally operates as a very oppressive force for sexual minorities. However, within the cases of these clinics and the creation of a national medical infrastructure for gay men and lesbians in the 1970s, we see the state having a pretty important role, and it's very contested at the individual site level at times, where some of the activists don't want to have any relationship with the state, and yet the people who are actually running these clinics realize that state funding is the way that they're going to stay open and viable over time. And the state has this very interesting relationship where it definitely doesn't want to encourage, you know, queerness or gay sexuality, and yet they see these individual clinics as very important public health sites that are treating cases of venereal diseases that otherwise go untreated. And so the state is trying to do this dance where it wants to stay at an arm's length, but also nurture this. Meanwhile, from the activist side, they want to provide the healthcare, but also not be closely associated with the state. And so over the course of the 1970s and into the early 1980s, each of the three case studies that I study have kind of a different evolution of their relationship with the state. Some of them immediately say, yes, we want to try and apply for all of these federal grants ASAP, and we'll just assume that we can do our own thing and keep it radical and activist-y at the site of providing services. Other places really try and keep the state out of their operations as much as possible, to the extent that like the Fenway Clinic in Boston doesn't even have its clinic approved by the licensing organization for clinics until 1978. It magically figures out how to operate all that time from 71 to 78 with very little state funds. And so, but the writing on the wall becomes pretty clear. If these clinics want to maintain viability, they need access to federal grants. And over the course of the 1970s, as the state under Nixon becomes kind of more of this kind of controlling force and a neoliberal force, these sites are forced to conform to certain expectations around how they're organized and how they what they do with their funding and that sort of thing. So my point in terms of Margot Kennedy's concept of the straight state is, yes, it is a straight state, and it's certainly an anti-queer state, but it also plays a very important role in the creation of gay health organizations and in the 1970s in particular, through the use of federal grants and kind of arm twisting and regulations around that money.
Mm-hmm. Great. So you've outlined already the really fraught relationship between the gay community and sort of the medical profession, which is very much a sort of impetus for the starting of these clinics. How, when they are, once they're set up, did they interact with quote unquote mainstream medical institutions?
Yeah, I think all of the activists across the board, I mean, they wanted to create gay-friendly spaces, but they also wanted to eventually not be necessary. And what that would mean is making mainstream medicine more knowledgeable about LGBTQ health needs or gay health needs at the time, right? So they, to varying degrees and to varying capacities, they engage mainstream medicine as much as possible, whether it's by trying to do research studies and publish in research journals so that existing doctors outside of these gay clinics can learn how to better treat gay patients, or whether it's by creating caucuses within most of the medical professional organizations that are specifically for gay and lesbian members so that they can find community, but also do the work of educating their straight colleagues. So by the end of the decade, we see a number of important shifts. One is that these gay professional organizations exist in almost every single facet of medical professional organizations, whether it's the AMA or the American Public Health Association, or so all of those different kind of specialized areas. But we also see strong relationships built with the CDC and even with pharmaceutical companies and certainly with one another, so that there is a robust infrastructure in place to try and help mainstream medicine understand gay health needs better and have easier access to the education that they need.
So how did this shift affect the relationship between doctors and the gay community when the AIDS epidemic hit in 1981 onwards?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, right? So It's hard to say, like, oh, all doctors everywhere knew more. I think that doctors that were dealing with gay patients for the first time had access to journal articles and whatnot to kind of help navigate that relationship. But the reality is that AIDS was something nobody saw. I mean, they saw it coming. A number of the doctors that I spoke with kind of said, we knew something was coming, we just didn't know what it was. And so, I think doctors who were trying to treat gay patients in the early AIDS crisis were so overwhelmed by what AIDS even was that the sexuality of their patients was just one part of a really confusing and impossible to really grasp problem that they were facing in terms of like an epidemiological puzzle. And so and the information that was available to them about how to treat gay patients and where to look for things, it helped, but also AIDS was just, a complete lacuna. It was an unknown.
Okay. So how did the community clinics themselves respond to the AIDS epidemic, and what were sort of the key successes for them in this moment, quote unquote success, and the failures as well?
Yeah. I think the quote unquote success says a lot, right? The reality is that gay health clinics didn't have some sort of special elixir that solved the AIDS crisis, obviously. What they did do, though, is they were the front lines. They were the places where community members turned. They wanted to know what was happening, and they were providing informational sessions. They were the sites that straight doctors would turn to. There's an interesting story of in the early 1980s, Fenway, which is literally a basement clinic off of an alley, off of a small side street in Boston. It does not look like a, wow, I really want to go get my health care there kind of place at this time. And yet in the early AIDS crisis, doctors from Harvard and from the CDC are heading into this basement to see how they're trying to do treatments, what kind of support services they're offering. They're doing a lot of kind of hospice level care, palliative care, where they learn how to support the doctors and the healthcare providers that are providing, care to patients that they can't save. And so these clinics provide really the frontline support of just trying to respond to this. They were the ones that were seen as the allies to LGBTQ community, and they did have access to relationships that they had nurtured with, doctors and research institutions across the country. And so they were often the ones that found the first AIDS cases in the cities and the regions where they operated. And they were the ones that made phone calls to the CDC and kind of helped put things together of what was happening and what it looked like. Then it became quite clear, even though there were significant funding cuts, those relationships within the CDC and the NIH and Big Pharma were relationships that were very important in terms of, figuring out where to do drug trials and how to roll it out and have communications about drug pricing when it became available. And, these were important lines of communications that started in the 1970s, but definitely, still remain intact today in many of the places.
Great. So just asking a slightly broader question, there's sort of a standard narrative often for how the gay rights movement develops in the 1970s, which is, you have gay liberation after Stonewall, and then slowly across the 1970s, activists kind of mainstream the movement, become quote unquote more respectable, and that initial radicalism wears off, although there are some historians who have written great works which challenge that chronology. How does your work interact / revise how we conceive of the gay rights movement in the 1970s?
Yeah. So this sort of declension narrative of radicalism, I think that that oversimplifies what is happening. I think that the activists that I looked at were practical people, right? Doctors are often very practical. They want to solve a problem that someone's facing and make their lives a little bit easier, generally speaking. And so it's not surprising that these clinics operate in much the same way, where they look at the world around them. And, we know that the shift over the 1970s and into the 1980s politically, money becomes harder. Politics become more conservative. Concerns about sexuality, particularly after the AIDS epidemic rears its head, it becomes very sticky. And so for these activists, it's more about how to survive and how to remain intact and be able to serve these communities in the ways that they can. And so from the outside, sure, you could say that they're becoming less radical. But I actually think that their decisions that they make, that there are board meetings and huge discussions and debates within these organizations where they're really thinking strategically about their choices and with eyes wide open of, is it better to shut the doors or is it better to stay open, even if we have to make some of these ideological compromises that we know we don't believe in. And so it's more an issue of kind of practicality and how to stay open. I think my sense is that a number of these organizations, obviously since the 1970s and 1980s, have become much more kind of corporatized, and they're huge mammoth organizations that have multi-million dollar budgets often. But my sense is that as they were making those decisions in the 1970s and 80s, they were doing it with their eyes wide open about what the implications would be. And they, they swallowed the good with the bad because they knew that what the services that they were offering were more important, were too important to just let go.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on the program today, Katie. That was a fascinating conversation. We just have time to ask you one more question, which is, what are you working on now?
What am I working on now? I am writing a book about the early AIDS response in the U.S. heartland. We know a lot about what was happening in New York and what was happening in San Francisco. We don't know a lot about what was happening in the middle of the country. And it turns out it's quite a different and complex story. So I'm working on that. And I'm also working on a reproductive justice history walking tour and podcast of Boston somewhere. Wow. Excitingly. So that's what I'm doing this summer. But then I'll return back to my book project in the fall. So yeah, that's what I'm working on right now. And I'm excited about it. I'm looking forward to kind of uncovering new aspects of this history and following through some of the themes that I uncover in the first book.
Great. Well, as someone who also researches the AIDS crisis, I'm really looking forward to seeing that research. Thanks again for being on the program.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. This was a lot of fun, and thanks for reading the book.